With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, mathematician Hannah Fry on the mathematics of love, and then John Ronson returns to Little Atoms for the sixth time to talk about his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Dr. Hannah Fry is a mathematician at University College London's Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis. In her day job, she uses mathematical models to study patterns in human behaviour, from riots and terrorism to trade and shopping. Alongside her academic position, she is currently a UCL Public Engagement Fellow, taking the joy of maths, such as it is, into theatres, pubs and schools. She also co-presents the BBC Worldwide YouTube channel and regularly appears on TV and radio, and most recently on Climate Change by Numbers on BBC Four. Her first TED Talk attracted more than 500,000 views and evolved into her first book, The Mathematics of Love, which we're going to be talking about today. So, Hannah, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks.
Why do you think maths can give us an insight into our love lives?
Into love. Well, I'm quite happy to admit that they don't seem to naturally sit that well together. I'm aware of that. The thing is, though, even though, I mean, I'd be the first person to say that you can't use equations or proofs to really capture sort of, you know, the thrill of romance or, you know, the real essence of love. But at the same time, I think that math can still give us something, because in our love lives, there are all sorts of different patterns in the way that we behave, in the way that we speak about each other, when we decide to settle down. And those patterns, math is uniquely placed to describe them and unpick them.
So let's talk about, what are our chances of meeting somebody in the first place? Somebody we consider compatible. Listeners will be very familiar with the Drake equation.
Yeah, of course.
So let's talk about the mathematician Peter Backus, who has sort of bastardised the Drake equation.
Yeah, in a really nice way, though. So the idea behind the Drake equation, then, is that you take the whole universe and you the more and more criteria you put on, you know, distance from a star, you know, ability to support life and so on and so on, you shrink down the number of potential candidates that you have. And what Backus did is the same thing, but for the number of potential candidates he has for his own heart, shall we say. So he starts off with, you know, everyone in the world, shrinks it down. He's only willing to look for people in London, shrinks it down further. He's only interested in one gender, shrinks it down further in that he wants them to find him attractive, and so on and so on and so on, and ends up with a number of 26 women in the whole of the world who would be available for him to date, shall we say. Which I think sounds quite pessimistic, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's quite, well, he's a bit fussy. I mean, I didn't
he's
Google.
He's a touch on the fussy side.
I didn't Google a picture of Peter Backus,
he's
but he's a mathematician.
He's very good looking.
Oh, very
actually, yeah.
Okay.
And he's also, I should add, he's also married now.
Yes, he's
so
married.
So it worked out for him in the end. But there were certain things, like, so for example, he says that he only finds 1 in 20 women attractive, which for me, I mean, maybe I'm just left, maybe I'm just less picky. But also he wants to have somebody who's got a university degree, so that sort of quarters the number of women that are available to him, and isn't willing to well, I mean, I suppose the biggest one is that he's not really willing to date anybody outside of London. But I think you know, the 26 women figure, you can sort of work out your own number using the same idea, but I think the 26 women thing does actually raise an interesting point, which is that the more and more criteria that you put on, the smaller and smaller your pool of potential partners shrinks. So I mean, I know that I certainly have some friends friends who've been single for a long time and are unbelievably picky. You know, they've got to have this job, they've got to like this music, their hair's got to be this colour, or like they can't wear brown shoes with jeans or whatever, right? And like what you're ultimately doing in that sense, if you sort of quantify it, is you're setting yourself a completely impossible challenge. Yeah, you're trying to find somebody. Your probability of finding somebody who matches your long list of criteria is almost zero.
So you probably shouldn't introduce you're fine. Me to your friends.
You've got, no, they're dark enough. That's fine. Yeah. Oh, wait, no, wait. Was it black shoes? I can't remember.
I think it was black shoes.
It was my sister,
it was
by the
way. Who's,
I
was it? Chamber, yeah. I think it was black shoes with jeans.
Yeah, right. Black shoes. Yeah, shouldn't do that. Yeah. Well, I don't care.
So this idea, we do this ourselves. I'm going to talk about computer dating more specifically a little later on. But we do this thing ourselves whenever we're filling out that form to say, you know, what we like, what do we want from a date. And you can, again, massively close down the number of people that would be compatible with you by doing that, can't you?
Yeah, of course. And I think the thing is that, you know, all of the evidence suggests that online dating algorithms, as sophisticated as they are at matching your own personal criteria, they do nothing for finding somebody who you're actually likely to be successful with in the long term. And I think that, you know, thinking of things in those terms, a checklist just doesn't really work. I mean, ultimately, you don't know whether you're going to like somebody until you actually meet them. And that, you know, all of the evidence points in that direction, that you cannot select predetermined criteria based on your own ideas that will guaranteed to find you somebody that you like. But I mean, I certainly, you know, anecdotally, I can think of countless people who ended up with somebody who, you know, they never thought they would be with in a million years. I mean, if I'm honest with you, I'm probably also one of those people with my husband. You asked me 10 years ago, I would never think that I would be with somebody, that I would end up, you know, finding happiness with somebody like that. But I think, I mean, that happens time and time again, right? Checklists don't work.
No matter how much we talk about maths, and as I said, we're going to talk about algorithms on computer dating and stuff, fundamentally, it's all down to looks, right? Isn't it?
No. No, etc.
So how important is beauty then? Let's talk about that.
Well, there has to, obviously, there's something in beauty, right? Thinking of how many different societies have ended up prizing beauty above almost anything else, you know, there has to be something in it. And there is. But it turns out that for the most part, the things that we seek out as attractive or seek out in a potential partner and deem attractive are actually just markers for our evolutionary pre-programming to look for the best sort of host, shall we say, for our future genes. So, for example, things like symmetry come out in lots of tests. So people really prize naturally symmetrical faces. But that is, it looks like, just a marker for health as a child. So every time when you're growing up, you have a little cold or something, your face becomes slightly asymmetric. So a symmetrical face is a sign of health. There are other things that, you know, in women reprise big eyes, big lips, sort of small childlike chins, lean figures, good waist-to-hip ratio, that kind of thing. And likewise in men, defined brows and, like, strong jawlines and muscular bodies. Both of those things come through with the sex hormones during puberty. So people who are likely to be very muscular, like men rather, who are likely to be very muscular and have very well-defined jaws, they also will have a high level of testosterone as they go through puberty, which is, again, just another marker for fertility, really. So what you're doing when you pick out somebody with nice big plump lips and, like, you know, all lovely little chin and big eyes, what you're really doing is you're sort of giving in, shall we say, to your evolutionary programming to want somebody who'd probably get pregnant quite quickly.
That symmetry, staying with, you know, an idea of maths, it's a bit of a myth, this idea of the golden ratio.
Yeah, but it's so prevalent. I mean, so actually, I have to confess, you know, until I properly did the research on this book, even I believed it, and I totally bought it. And it says quite a lot about my inability to think critically, I think, if I'm honest. But so it's said, in case you haven't heard this, it says that the perfect face matches the proportions of the golden ratio, so that your mouth will be 1.618 times the width of your nose, that your brows and so on. But ultimately, absolutely not true. Complete rubbish. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, well, ultimately, it's just not science, right? Like, you can't just take loads of faces, measure random ratios until something that roughly matches your theory. I mean, it's just a completely the opposite of scientific process, right? But also, you know, 1.618 and so on, it's an irrational number, right? Mm-hmm. So it goes on forever. So how do you decide, you know, maybe like the width of your nose and mouth might be, you know, roughly 1.6. Mm-hmm. But how do you decide exactly where your nose starts or where your mouth ends or where your ear starts? You know, it's just rubbish.
The other thing I wanted to talk about in this section is this thing, the decoy effect, which I think will give hope to a lot of people listening, I might suspect.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing about beauty is that you sort of hope that there's some, or I hoped anyway, given the remit of the book was about mathematics, I hoped that there was a mathematical idea somewhere. And this is, you know, one of the places where it does exist. So when people make choices, when people make decisions, you can wrap it up in something called discrete choice theory, which is very, very mathematical. But it's also got results that are quite tangible and easy to, well, that we're all very familiar with, because they often get exploited by people who are trying to get you to choose their products. So one of them is this thing called the decoy effect, which is that if you're trying to like sell a product, you can make it look better by simultaneously marketing a very similar but slightly inferior version, right, of that same product.
So popcorn at the cinema.
Exactly, yeah. So like medium versus large popcorn.
Yeah.
And then there's a small as well, right? So the large popcorn looks ridiculously expensive until you realise that the small popcorn is like 50p cheaper. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, well, yeah, actually maybe it is a bit of a better bargain. Like, it kind of just serves to make it look better. So there's an economist called Dan Ariely who has applied this decoy effect to human beauty. Mm-hmm. And what he did was he found two of his students, actually, who were did surveys and found out that these two male faces were considered roughly the same level of attractiveness, right? 50% of people would go for one, 50% of people would go for the other. And what he did is he then took one of the faces and created like an uglified, Photoshop-uglified version of that face. And then presented the three faces together, two originals and one uglified version, and asked people who they thought was more attractive. And where an uglified version of your own face appears, you suddenly become the much more attractive option, right? Mm-hmm. So 75% of people chose the original face, which had an uglified version. Nobody chose the uglified version, but the uglified version served to make the original face much more attractive. And if you change the person that you're uglifying, the results switch round, right? So 75% of people then go for the other face. And the sort of implications of this study, I think, are quite interesting, which is that basically, when you go out on the pool,
what your ugly mate.
Well, yeah, but not just your ugly mate. They need to look as similar to you as possible, but just noticeably inferior.
So I guess a brother or something.
Yeah, exactly. An uglier brother. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just need to find like another 6 foot tall ginger girl who's like, you know, marginally, like, slightly uglier.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Hannah Fry. We're talking about her book, The Mathematics of Love: Patterns, Proofs, and the Search for the Ultimate Equation. And Hannah, I want to talk now about game theory in all its
glory.
Weird and interesting
glory.
And we have to set out that we are sort of stepping into that very murky, falling territory of the pickup artist a little bit here. But we'll talk about some of the applications of game theory and the stable marriage problem, first of all. Explain to us what that is.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, the idea is, imagine you're in a bar, lots of single people in the bar, and everybody really wants to, you know, hook up with somebody and go home, right? Like, hook up with somebody. And I suppose as well, everybody in their heads has like a list of who they think is most attractive. So you can split all the people in the bar into two groups. Mm-hmm. The group who are proactive and approach people, and possibly risks some humiliating rejection, let's be fair. And the other group who sit back and wait for their choice of suitors,
yeah.
But you never have to be rejected or humiliated. So in that sense, the setup is is equivalent to a mathematical problem called the stable marriage problem. And in that, once it's put into the language of maths, you can prove that the people who do the approaching, the people who are proactive, always, always, always end up much better off than the people who stand back and wait. And it kind of makes sense if you think it through, in that if you're proactive and you go out and go to people that you like, you're going to start at the top of your list and you're going to work down. So you'll end up with the best person who will have you. Whereas if you stand back and wait for people to come to you, all you can do is end up with the least bad person who happens to approach you. But it's kind of interesting that you can sort of prove that being proactive is a positive thing, which I think is something I probably should have known about when I was single. Because I was rubbish at it.
So more classically a game theory thing then. So Robert Axelrod's idea, tit for tat, which has, time and time again proved to be the most effective approach. In terms of, for both men and women attempting to woo each other, let's talk about how game theory can
apply. So the thing about game theory, right, is that you're trying to exploit the weaknesses of your opponent. I mean, that's ultimately what it's about, right? Or at least, that's how you frame it. So a lot of the game theory that's applied to dating is unfortunately based on, extreme gender stereotypes. In particular, that men only ever want to have sex, and women, of course, are constantly trying to trick men into marrying us. So a lot of the ideas are based on, on that and trying to get the most out of, the other person in that respect. But Axelrod's tit for tat, I really like when applied to game theory, because it actually ends up giving you a much more positive message. Because, the idea is that if somebody doesn't call you, for example, essentially, every time that you interact with somebody, you're playing a version of the prisoner's dilemma, right? In that they can misbehave and still have you sort of fawning after them, and that's ultimately going to be the biggest payoff that they can get. But likewise, that means in the future you're less likely to trust them. So you can kind of think of a relationship as though it's an iterated prisoner's dilemma, that you're kind of continually playing this game against each other. And in that sense, Axelrod's tit-for-tat strategy helps you decide, what to do if somebody doesn't call you, or if somebody misses your birthday, or if somebody's just, generally a bit of a dick. Right? And the idea then is, so there's four things to Axelrod's tit-for-tat. So first up is to be clear, so not play games within the game. Secondly, to be nice. So unless somebody does something bad to you, unless somebody, messes you around or doesn't call you or whatever, there's no reason to be nasty. So generally be nice unless you're given reason to do otherwise. The next one is to be provocable. So if somebody does something bad to you, you shouldn't allow yourself to be exploited. So you should punish them with something that's measured, a measured response, right? Something that's kind of an equivalent weight. So if they don't call you, maybe don't return their call when they finally do, or, give it a day or whatever. Or if they cancel on you, cancel on them. And then the final thing is to be forgiving, which I think is something that people often forget, which is that once a bad deed has been punished, you should go back to being nice as quickly as possible and then go back to cooperating with each other.
So I mentioned we were going to talk about online dating, and there's definitely maths involved here. I mean, it's become, over the years, more and more important. And you talk about particularly what's probably the biggest dating site now, OkCupid, and it's set up by a couple of mathematicians, and the algorithm that they use is supposedly very sophisticated. Although it doesn't actually seem that effective.
it's doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is deliver you people who match your own personal criteria, right? And in that respect, it's very good.
These are criteria that we've chosen
yourself, exactly, by answering a series of questions and saying what you want, what response you want in your partner. So in that respect, it's very good at that. But just a slight issue is that you don't know what you want until you find it, unfortunately. And there's kind of countless pieces of evidence of this, but probably one of the most profound is the evidence from OkCupid themselves, right? Which is where they did an experiment on humans, was the blog post that they called it, which is amazing. And so this guy, Christian Rudder, one of the co-founders of OkCupid, essentially what they did is they took some people who genuinely were a 90% match percentage, and they compared them with another group who were actually a 30% match percentage. But the group that were in the 30%, they lied to them and they told them that they were 90% matched with each other, and then looked at how those different relationships evolved over time. Now, in terms of the chances of messaging people, you're much more likely to message people and get into some kind of a conversation if you believe that you're a good match, which means people put some sort of store into the algorithms. But in terms of prolonged messages, I mean, there is a slight difference between the people who really were compatible, in inverted commas, and people who were just duped into thinking that they were. But it's really slight. I mean, the chance of, like, actually having more than four messages with somebody, I mean, it's in the teens for both cases. So people put store in these algorithms, but they're not so good at, like, actually getting people.
How could you talk about how they could improve that? So what would we need to do to make it work better?
So the only thing in the academic research which has been shown to be a long-term predictor is something called non-conscious synchrony. So basically the idea is that you don't know what you want until you find it, but as soon as you find it, your body gives you away completely, right? So I guess we've all heard of this thing, you know, your pupils dilate, your heart rate increases, all of those different things. But also, the way you behave starts to mimic the other person, right? So your speech patterns end up synchronising, your laughter ends up synchronising, you end up mimicking their body movements. I feel massively self-conscious right now. All of these things start to happen, and all of these things you can also, I mean, you could, it would be fairly close to being able to track those using technology, right? So you could use, for example, if you had an online internet date that was like a speed date, you could use sort of a Skype-like technology. You could use image recognition software to track where people were mimicking each other's body language. You could use Siri-like technology to track people's vocal patterns and their speech patterns. And then, at the end of a very short internet day, you could deliver a meaningful match percentage that's actually, in certain cases, shown to be a genuine predictor of long-term compatibility.
I find this a bit fascinating, particularly because it's like, it's basically, you know, body language. It seems like some pseudo-scientific bullshit from the 1970s, but it's actually
it's real. And to be honest, it's something that I think is totally fascinating, and I don't know an enormous amount about it. But the thing is, have you ever noticed, like, when you have a conversation about body language, everybody suddenly becomes really self-conscious? Have you noticed?
You can sit on your hands and don't move. Don't play with your hair, whatever you do.
Playing with your hands, I know, exactly. Don't touch your face. Oh, God, touch my face.
We talked earlier about the decoy effect, and I'd sort of questioned whether or not looks was the thing that mattered above all things before. In the internet dating world, this is really counterintuitive, but it pays to be a bit ugly.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I love this. I love this so much. Yeah, so the OkCupid guys have... on OkCupid, there's a voluntary section where you can rate how attractive you think people are between 1 and 5. And you can compare that to how many messages people receive to get some sense of how looks relate to popularity. And the thing is, it's not just the best-looking people who end up getting all the messages. Actually, the people who do the best are the ones who divide opinion the most. So the people who some people think are really gorgeous, but other people think a bit ugly. And I think the reason is that people, when you're sending messages in an online dating context, you're really thinking of your own chances, right? And if somebody is just classically beautiful, you imagine that they're going to get loads and loads of messages. And, you know, why would you throw your hat into the ring and risk being humiliated? Whereas if you spot somebody who you think is really gorgeous, but you suspect that other people aren't going to be that interested, it's like less competition and an extra incentive for you to get in touch. But I also think it's kind of worth remembering, when it comes to online dating, you're not trying to attract everybody. You're not trying to appeal to the masses. You're just trying to attract the people who are right for you. So in that sense, and kind of proving that it works, you're much better off to just play up to whatever it is that makes you different, which is sort of the opposite of what people do, right? People try and, you know, minimise whatever they think makes them unattractive. But you shouldn't do that. You should just, like, basically let it all hang out.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I guess the reason most people are, you know, taking part in this whole stressful world of dating, and online dating particularly, is because they're, you know, they're looking for somebody to settle down with eventually. So I want to talk about optimal stopping theory. Let's talk about when is the right time to settle down.
Yeah, right. So I suppose this is one of the more, shall we say, abstract bits of maths that's like, so it's not based on real data. But the idea is that if you think of your dating life, right, the time that you're going to spend dating, for most of us, as soon as we sort of cash in and settle down with somebody, mm-hmm. we can't look ahead to see all the people that we could have met if we'd gone to the bars and, you know, stayed online or whatever. You can't see those people. And equally, as soon as you've rejected somebody, once you've dumped somebody, it's very hard to go back, right? And if you frame it in that way, you can begin to look at it mathematically. And in that sense, you can start to ask the question of when is the best time to stop and settle down mm-hmm. in your dating life. Because obviously, you don't want to leave it too long if you want to maximise your chance of happiness, you know. But equally, it's generally not advisable to just, you know, cash in and, like, marry the first person who comes along mm-hmm. shows you any attention at all. So where in that dating window should you stop and start thinking seriously about marriage? So as all of us do, I think, you can, you know, most of us, I should say, spend some time playing the field when we're young, mm-hmm. and then at a certain point we start thinking more seriously. And if you frame this in a mathematical way, it turns out that the ideal time for that rejection phase is 37% of your dating life. Mm-hmm. So if you start dating when you're 15, say, and ideally you want to be settled down by the time you're 35, then what you should do is, before your 22nd birthday, just do whatever you want, basically. Have a nice time, mm-hmm. play the field, have, like, boyfriends and girlfriends and stuff, but don't take any of them really seriously. Mm-hmm. And then after your 22nd birthday has passed, then you should pick the next person that comes along that is better than everybody that you've seen before. And if you do that, you can prove that you're mathematically maximising your chances of finding the best person who's available for you.
But that would also presumably entail leaving somebody who you thought was great, but it's not.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this
right
meant, I'll be honest, this comes with risks, like quite big risks. Because for some people, you're going to meet the perfect person for you before your 22nd birthday, right? Mm-hmm. So this method doesn't work all of the time. It only works just over a third of the time, which is, I mean, like, let's be honest, still quite low chance. I mean, I think this is what I mean. Like, this is much more into abstraction. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily guarantee it. Like, suggest anybody should go away and dump somebody just because they're under 22. Definitely not. But the thing is, that I think it's quite interesting, is just that one simple step of having a rejection phase of 37%. You increase your chances of finding somebody from, you know, actually quite small. So imagine you were going to date 20 people in your life. If you just pick one of them at random, mm-hmm. the chance that they're the perfect person for you is 1 in 20, right? Mm-hmm. Or 5%. But using this method, you can increase it to 37%. So from 5% to 37% chance of success, I think, is pretty profound, right? Mm-hmm. But just, you're going to lose out 2/3 of the time.
Finally then, once we've finally met the person, once we've met the person who we want to stay with, what can maths tell us about staying together? How can we prolong that relationship?
Yeah, well, so this is my favourite bit of all, and it's based on some really serious, genuine academic research, which is that a psychologist called John Gottman and his team have basically observed couples in conversation with each other for decades, right? And they've recorded them having a conversation about the most contentious issue in their relationship. And what they've done is they've worked out a way to score how positive or negative mm-hmm. everything that everybody's doing in that conversation. And just from those scores, so sort of how positive were you, how negative were you, mm-hmm. they can predict whether a particular couple will get divorced mm-hmm. with a 90% accuracy, which is pretty astonishing, right? But what's more astonishing is, I think anyway, looking not only just at how positive or negative people are overall, but how people's positivity and negativity can influence their partner and send them down into spirals of negativity mm-hmm. or take them out of negative stuff and back into positivity, and looking at kind of how those patterns and the ebb and flow of a conversation evolves. So they teamed up with a mathematician called James Murray mm-hmm. To sort of study these, you know, these dynamics. And they came up with a series of equations which captures how things work. But one of the most important terms, or the most important term, I should say, in this equation is something called the negativity threshold, right? Which is basically how annoying one person has to be before they provoke a really strong reaction in their partner, a strong negative reaction, I should say, in their partner. So you might think that, like, the best relationships, the ones that last forever, are all about compromise and about giving each other space to be yourself and about, you know, not bringing stuff up unless it's a really big deal, mm-hmm. and so on. So people who would have, like, a really high threshold for negativity. Mm-hmm. But actually, it turns out that the opposite is true. It's the people who have a really low negativity threshold who end up doing really well in the long term. So these are the people who, if something bothers them, they speak up about it immediately. They never let small stuff end up being a really big deal. They kind of allow each other room to complain and are constantly repairing and resolving tiny, tiny issues in their relationship before anything becomes a big deal. And I think that's really good. It's kind of counterintuitive. But I mean, ultimately, what it's saying is that you should communicate openly and honestly and as often as possible.
That's a good lesson to learn. A good point for us to...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finish on. So I've been talking to Hannah Fry. We've been talking about her book, The Mathematics of Love. Patterns, Proofs, and the Search for the Ultimate Equation. So, Hannah, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
In and telling
thank
me
Thank you
that.
Very much.
I'm Ben Goldacre. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
John Ronson is an award-winning writer and documentary maker. He's the author of many best-selling books, including Frank, the true story that inspired the movie, Lost at Sea, the John Ronson mysteries, The Psychopath Test, The Men Who Stare at Goats, and Them, Adventures with Extremists. His first fictional screenplay, Frank, co-written with Peter Strawn, starred Michael Fassbender, and John's latest book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So John, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Yeah,
I think the sixth time.
I believe every time I've got a book out, I come and do it. It's like the constants in life are death, taxes, and Neil Denny.
This is true. Now, it's a bit noisy in here. We're recording this backstage at the Colchester Arts Centre, so perhaps we should talk about why we're here, first of all. What are you doing?
I'm giving a talk, an evening of public shaming. I'm doing a...
People are going to be putting the stocks and things, aren't they?
Au contraire. I'm going to be... So basically, I'm here for like 2.5 weeks, and I'm doing a mix of like paid gigs and free gigs, which is sort of the way of the future. About 5 years ago... I was giving a talk in Sheffield, and a guy came up to me afterwards called Mike McCarthy, and he said, do you go up and down the country, like, talking at literary festivals for free? And I said, yes. And he said, and have you noticed that, like, the ticket prices are, like, 10 quid, which means, like, if 400 people came, that means, like, £4,000 was made, yet you didn't make any money out of it. And I said, yes! And he said, has this been annoying you? And I said, yes! And he said, well, I'm going to change all that. So I signed with him, and now you get paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, not like a huge amount, but, you know, you get paid. So what I do now when I've got a book out is I do a mix of like, you know, water. So like this kind of talks that you used to do where people just pay like £3 and that makes the publishers happy because it means people are more likely to buy a book if they've only paid £3 for the ticket. And then with other talks like this one where the ticket prices are a little bit higher, maybe 10-12 quid, and I get paid.
So we're going to be talking about So You've Been Publicly Shamed, the new book. And this is it's such a brilliant idea, this book. It's so topical. You've been obviously writing this book for, you know, books take a long time to write, so some of the instances of internet public shaming that happened obviously happened years ago, but every single day, it seems, there's a new example of this. So when did you first notice it was a thing?
I suppose, I mean, I noticed it in a positive way at first. I noticed when Jan Moyer in the Daily Mail wrote a column blaming Stephen Gately from Boyzone's death on being gay and in a civil partnership, even though the coroner, who you would assume would know more than she would, said it was natural causes. And Twitter was outraged. You know, we weren't going to take this kind of resurgence of old-time bigotry, and so we mobilised. And I think that was probably the first great Twitter mobilisation in about 2012, I think.
Looking back on that from the perspective of having now written this book and seen subsequent ones that have happened, do you think the response to that one was out of proportion to what happened?
No, I don't. However, what I would say is that I interviewed one person for my book who didn't want to be named, like a recipient of a terrible public shaming. He didn't want to be named, and so in the end I decided not to put him in my book at all because everybody else in the book was named. And he said after his public shaming was so ruthless, he couldn't bear, you know, he felt that Jan Moyer of the Daily Mail, you know, he just felt sorry for her. And he said he would never have felt that way before, you know, he'd been publicly shamed. Because it's only when you've been publicly shamed that you know just how horrific it is, how kind of deeply, profoundly traumatising, like contrary to, you know, everything that makes us human beings. But, you know, given that, I think I'd be living in a kind of Disney world if I thought, you know, we must get rid of all shamings. Even a part of me sort of feels that, because part of me thinks that, you know, shaming has become such a kind of default trigger-happy position, and it's become such a kind of huge part of our lives now, and it's so corrosive and disgusting that, you know, maybe the only way out of it is to, like, you know, eradicate shamings even against people who deserve it. But at the same time, I sort of feel, you know, that's a little bit too Gandhi for me, you know. So I still think, yes, shamings like that one are still appropriate. I, you know, I can't advocate against that.
Just a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago, you had a bit of a taste of, not exactly a public shaming, but a shade of what this feels like yourself. And one of the people that you write about in the book basically took exception to it.
Yeah, I think it's called a flame war, apparently. I only discovered this afterwards. It made me feel good to know that it's so, you know, happened so often. It's got a name. My book was excerpted in the New York Times, and it was primarily the chapter about Justine Sacco, the woman who did the tweet, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. And I wrote a very sort of compassionate piece about her. And it got excerpted in the New York Times, and you know, 90% of the people who read it, and it went like hugely viral, probably more than pretty much anything I've ever written before. And about 90% of the reaction was very positive, like we got Justine wrong, and people felt really sorry for her, and people liked my piece. But what happened was another person in my book, a woman called Adria Richards, was briefly mentioned in that piece and took exception. I think because she didn't like the way that the New York Times had summarised her story. Anyway, became extremely vocal about it. And the next thing I knew, I was getting like hundreds of furious messages from her supporters. Now, I was thinking, this is a little bit rum, because she hasn't actually read my book. She's like, you know, and in fact, you know, if she had objections when she'd read my book, that was another matter. She just read, like, a paragraph that was a summary in the New York Times. So anyway, I didn't respond at all. But I did find it upsetting. I read every single tweet, and they snaked their way into me, and I felt anxious and upset, because that's what that does to you. It's a powerful thing. I didn't reply to anybody. The one that really made me smile was somebody wrote, why isn't John Ronson replying to any of us. And then somebody else wrote, oh, John Ronson only replies to men. And I thought, I have no male friends. I am sexless. I'm like a eunuch from Game of Thrones. And it just made me realise, you know, I'm just a kind of blank canvas for those people's ideology. And that's what happens time and time again in public shaming. You're just a kind of pawn in somebody's predetermined ideology. And frankly, I've always been opposed to ideology being more important than human beings. And so I found once again, I saw that, you know, here's another example of why ideology should never be put above humanity.
You say that you're a blank canvas for the public to put their own ideas onto you about. And funnily enough, one of the sort of first chapters in this book, you talk about this experience, the infomorph.
Yeah, spambot.
Yeah,
I believe is the actual term. Do you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, tell us what happened.
Okay, well, I accidentally typed my name into Google and discovered that there was a, God knows what I was trying to type into Google, probably Ron Swanson from Parks and Recreation, accidentally typed in John Ronson.
As you do.
And discovered that there was another John Ronson on Twitter with my face.
Yeah.
And my name, but with a completely different personality. Frankly, it was a twat. It was like, all it wanted to talk about was like its soirees, its dinner parties, what kind of lemongrass it was going to make its stew. And it was being followed by people I knew from real life who kind of, you know, suddenly thought, you know, why is John Ronson?
John's had a breakdown.
Yeah, why is John Ronson suddenly so interested in fusion cooking? So I found out who was behind it, and it was these three intellectuals. One was an academic, one was a researcher. So I said, can you take down your spam bot? And I said, we prefer the term infomorph. So I said, but it's taken my identity. And I said, the infomorph isn't taking your identity. It is repurposing social media data into an infomorphic aesthetic. So I sort of obviously felt this kind of tightness in my chest. And finally, I said, look, if you won't take down your spam bot, maybe we can meet and I can film it and you can explain the rationale behind the spam bot. And they said, yeah, we'd very much like to meet to explain the rationale behind the infomorph. And I said, I'm very glad to hear that because I'm looking forward to hearing the rationale behind the spam bot. So I met them and we had this kind of shrill fight while I was shrill. And I put it on YouTube.
Yeah, it's a great video because you do get angry, which you don't often. You don't often see you in your, well, not in the film.
I got angry yesterday. I was giving a talk about this book at Future Fest, and I told the Justine Sacco story. And at the end, somebody put their hand up and said, "You're onto a loser here because Justine Sacco is a racist, and you shouldn't be defending a racist." And I said, "You know, I believe my book proves absolutely that she's not a racist." And we had a bit, and I got really annoyed. I was like, you know, after everything I've just said, I mean, I don't sound like a patrician dad, but it's like, after everything I've just said, are you saying that you still think Justine Sacco deserved what she got? Mm-hmm. And he was, yes. And so we had a real ding-dong. I think they're going to put it online. And I hope that I was as awesome as I felt, but I might not have been. I might have just been shrill again.
So did they take the infomorph down?
They were shamed.
Did they take the spam bot down?
They were shamed into acquiescence and took it down. Well, they didn't take it down, they froze it. So it's still there, but archived, but it doesn't tweet anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember at one point he said the internet is not the real world, but the internet is the real world. And I was surprised at how much I cared about my identity being stolen. Identity is important.
Well, there was no doubt. I mean, in the film and in the book, like, they basically suggest that you're being a bit sort of arrogant, to suggest that it's you. There's lots of people called John Ronson, but it has your photograph. It's very clearly supposed to be you.
It was a very disingenuous argument. It was. And they must have known that. Mm-hmm. I still don't quite understand what they were doing. I bear them no ill will. I mean, the only reason why I even brought this story up again and put it in my book was because, you know, I felt it was a good way to start the book, because here was me enjoying publicly shaming somebody before I kind of learned my ways.
And your followers started getting really nasty about it.
Yeah, exactly, and I loved it. And so I felt, you know, if I'm going to write a book that's against public shaming, I have to admit that at the beginning of this, like all of us, I was in favour of public shaming.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's talk about public shaming, well, in a historical context. So this is something that we used to do. yes. as a punishment, as a regular punishment. In what way? You did some sort of research on this, didn't you?
Yeah, I went up to the Massachusetts Archive, and yeah, I mean, you know, people would be whipped and put in the stocks and the pillory, and the reason why it died out in about 1840, I think, roughly, give or take 10 years, was because it was considered too brutal. I mean, all the great thinkers of the time were saying, we have to stop this, it's too brutal. Mm-hmm. There's a misconception. I think a lot of people think it died out because it was too ineffective. I think we want to think that because we want to feel happy to publicly shame people. We want to have our cake and eat it. We want to do it, but we don't want to think that we're destroying lives.
So what is it about... What is it about the internet that's brought this out then? What is it about social media? I guess, I mean, it's not just the internet that... You don't necessarily just talk about instances on the internet in the book. But, I mean, I think the ones that people will be most familiar with are from Twitter and things. And we're all on Twitter, so let's talk about the internet. Versus, what is it about Twitter, for instance, that makes this happen?
I think it's partly because we're like drone strike operators on Twitter. We're not looking our victims in the face. And I think it's partly... because Twitter is this kind of mutual approval machine. I mean, it's, as my friend Adam Curtis says, you know, it's that mutual grooming. We surround ourselves with people who feel the same way we do. And so we just keep congratulating each other, you know, as we take people down. There's no incentive to go against the tide. And in fact, going against the tide can be dangerous. I noticed Helen Lewis from The New Statesman reviewed my book and said that she felt sorry for Justine Sacco as it was happening, but was too afraid to say anything.
Yeah, I think that's a position that a lot of people find themselves in when these various arguments are going on.
And isn't that weird that we've created that system for ourselves?
Where do you think... I mean, is there a line? I mean, we've already talked about the Jan Moore thing. But is there a sort of line where it's...
Okay.
Where it sort of crosses over to be non-acceptable? Because I say that because, obviously, everybody has got their own perspective on this. People all have their own opinions. And the people... So there's... If we say, OK, so there's public shaming of somebody that... does a sort of what would be perceived as a minor transgression, and it seems like the punishment is out of proportion. Then there's trolling. There's the people like, you know, Anita Sarkeesian or whatever, or, you know, our own Rebecca Watson, who seem to attract the opprobrium of a ridiculous amount of appalling people.
Yeah.
And then there's people that are called out, the Jan Moores, and there'll be like, you know, some...
Yeah.
Emily Thornberry would be not particularly necessarily example of that.
Emily Thornberry, I think, is like a sort of... She's a sort of... Because she's no Jan Moyer.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It's a very borderline case, but an interesting one because of that. I mean, I was going to say, you know, somebody who's a UKIP councillor saying something racist or whatever. Then.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Those are three very different cases. And for me, when I was writing this book, one of those three types of things was much more interesting than the other two. And that was like the disproportionate mass punishment of somebody like Justine Sacco, who didn't really do anything much wrong at all. And that to me was more... Trolls, there was a couple of reasons why trolls were less interesting. Mm-hmm. Although I think I'll try and say something out loud that I've been thinking. So two things, which I'm slightly worried will come over as like offensive or outrageous, but they're not intended to be, so I hope they don't come over that way. But I'm going to say what I feel about
trolls. But nobody will take any notice of that caveat, obviously, when you get probably ashamed about it.
Exactly. If somebody like Rebecca Watson is sort of bombarded by misogynistic trolls, it's horrible. And in fact, I've been with Rebecca when it was happening, and it was like kind of deeply distressing for her. But, and I'm not trying to make like sort of pain equivalencies here, but the point is she... Because the people who were trolling her were like an outrageous, misogynistic group of lunatics, she would have had a kind of support network who would have rallied around her and fought her case.
Yeah.
Somebody like Justine Sacco had nobody, totally isolated. And that's the most profound sort of social shaming when...
Even her family were...
Yeah, when everybody agrees that you're a monster. So even Rebecca, at her like worst amount of trolling, would have had people supporting them, and so I think by the very nature of that, it surely isn't as traumatizing. Because what's so traumatizing is being told by everybody that you need to get out. I mean, that's unthinkable. Mm-hmm. So that's I think one of the things I wanted to say about trolling. But at the same time, I understand that's like saying, you know, oh, a victim of trolling. It's a bit like Richard Dawkins saying, oh, poor Muslimah. I'm not trying to say that, but I suppose what I am trying to say is if you've been a victim of trolling, don't think that you know what it was like to be Justine Sacco, because there's a profound difference.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to John Ronson about his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And John, in this next part, I want to look at some of the examples of the various types of public shaming that you look at. I really want to start with somebody who has also been on Little Atoms numerous times, Jonah Lehrer.
Oh, has he?
Yeah, I interviewed him twice, and I interviewed him about the creativity book just before the thing happened.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you remind us what this story is about.
Jonah, okay, so I think this is an extraordinary story. In fact, if I'm being totally honest and narcissistic, I think the Jonah Lehrer Michael Moynihan story is the best bit of writing I've ever done. I'm incredibly proud of it. It's the story of Michael Moynihan, who's a freelance journalist. He's now much more successful, but at the time, you know, he was kind of scraping a living as a blogger and a freelancer. And he discovered, kind of just through luck, that Jonah Lehrer had faked some Bob Dylan quotes, but added words to Bob Dylan quotes, and basically messed around with Bob Dylan quotes. And so Michael emailed Jonah, and Jonah, in what is kind of breathtaking miscalculation, instead of saying, "Oh, you're right, I'm an idiot, I'll correct it in the second edition," basically wrote back to say, "I'm right, it's history that's wrong," and just dug himself. You know, I say at one point in the book, if our shameworthiness lies in the space between who we are and how we present ourselves to the world, Jonah's space was at the size of the Grand Canyon. So,
yeah, that is a good line.
Yeah. he just dug himself deeper and deeper and deeper until finally he knew he was caught. And he broke, begged Michael. 20 times a day he phoned him, 25 times a day, begged him not to publish. And then suddenly these two men are just trapped in this nightmare together. It's kind of nightmare that neither of them wanted, but neither could escape it. Because Michael felt he had to publish.
Yeah.
Or else he would have been the kind of, he would have like buckled. So it's such an interesting story about the relationship between these two men. You know, it could easily be a stage play.
Then, of course, it turned out that, you know, when more investigation was done, that
Jonah had done worse things.
Yeah.
The worst of all was, I think most people would agree that the worst thing that he did was plagiarising some paragraphs from Christian Jarrett of the British Psychological Society. His other stuff was self-plagiarism, which, even at my most self-righteous, I can't see that as a particularly bad thing. I'm going to stand up on stage tonight and tell jokes I've told in the past.
But this is a performance.
True. I think the New Yorker would have had the right to get pissed off with him for reusing some paragraphs he'd written in the Wall Street Journal. But I think that's a matter, that's a matter for him and his employer. You know, I think he would have the right, as the owner of that material, to reuse it. You know, he wasn't plagiarising anybody else. The reason why I say this is because there's a couple of lines in the psychopath test which people really like. It's what I'm talking about, how I say, if you want to get away with wielding true malevolent power, be boring, because journalists love writing about eccentric people. So, you know, which is why sort of the bankers got away for it so long, because they were just boring, and journalists didn't want to write about them because they didn't want to write boring stories. And I thought that was a really interesting point. And I'd written it previously. I think I'd written it either in The Guardian or in this little collection I had out called What I Do, and nobody paid much attention. And so I put it in the psychopath test. I thought, this is a really interesting thing I'm saying here, and I want to give it like a second chance. And so I put it in the psychopath test, and sure enough, it's become one of the most popular parts of that book. It's one of the most quoted parts of that book. I'm proud of that. I'm not embarrassed by that. It's like when a band brings out a single that nobody listens to, and then they re-release it a couple of years later, and it does really well. So that's why I can't get too annoyed about Jonah's self-plagiarism, because that's, for me, that's a positive story, the story I just said.
Justin Sacco, you've mentioned a few times already, but mm-hmm. give us a recap of what actually happened, the sort of events as they unfolded. And they literally did unfold in that sort of way.
So she tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." Now, obviously, well, not obviously, but in truth, she wasn't intending to be racist. She wasn't intending to gleefully flaunt her privilege. She was trying to make an anti-racist... I don't know if anti-racist is the right word. She was trying to make a joke making fun of people who gleefully flaunt her privilege in much the same way that Randy Newman would write rednecks or short people.
Well, I thought at the time, I remember this happening and thought that's basically what... That's a lame attempt at a Sarah Silverman joke.
Or a lame attempt at an episode of South Park.
Yeah.
You know, or lame attempt at a Randy Newman song. Anyway, if people did realise that... And I'm sure a lot of people did. They still tore her to pieces. And by the time her plane landed...
Yeah, and so literally she was flying to South Africa while all of this was going on.
Oblivious to... Yeah. And it was horrific. I mean, it was torture. I mean, you know, 100,000 people waiting in the dark for her to land so they could leap out at her and yell boo. It's torture. You know, we discovered torture that day. That's literally, like, startling people... so extremely. I write about that in The Menesteric Goats. Mm-hmm. You know, we discovered torture. We were like Guantanamo interrogators waiting for Justin Sacco to land. Mm-hmm. It's awful. And it's one of the most brutal things I've ever seen.
And of course she lost her job.
Yeah, but lost herself, you know, for a year. I mean, she's okay again now. It took her a year. But the two things that made it okay was she got a new job eventually and I came along with my story, which sort of reconnected her to the world. You know, people were like, "I'm sorry for what we did, Justine."
I'm Natalie Haynes. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to talk about the sort of post-shaming world, the end of this, and what we can do to sort of deal with it. So, yeah, so talk about this company, Reputation.com.
I mean, you have to be pretty rich, or you have to be pretty rich if it's like a big shaming, if it's all over the place like Lindsay Stone. Somebody like Justine Sacco, I think it's impossible. But it's kind of like a sort of, you know, privatised version of Google's right to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. They can manipulate the search results. They can trick the Google algorithms into thinking that nice judgments about this person are more important than bad judgments. It's all done with, like, it's kind of complicated, but it's all to do with kind of page rank. You know, certain pages have got more prominence than other pages, so your LinkedIn page, you know, automatically goes high up the Google search results and so on. And they try and get the bad stuff buried to a place where nobody looks, which is like page two, page three of Google. And I think they do it well. Lindsay was a hard case. Mm-hmm. They all really cared for Lindsay. They all felt deeply sorry for her, and so did I. Mm-hmm. And usually I think they work with really wealthy people, so I think they thought it was really nice to be able to work with somebody who didn't have any money. And to do it for me, you know. So it was a good, happy experience.
The other thing, you attend a group session, I think, called the Shame Eradication Workshop. Yeah.
Well, that's what I called it. I mean, its actual title is Radical Honesty. Yeah, where the way to get rid of shame is to just have no secrets, just be completely honest about yourself, your perversions, what you think of other people. Just ends up with everybody just yelling at each other. I didn't find it hugely successful. I understand what they're doing. It's like, you know, again, our shame worthiness lies in the gap between who we are and how we present ourselves to the world. What feels no shame? A dog. So be like a dog, just living instantly in the moment. But it was kind of weird. I'll tell you one funny story. This didn't happen when I was there, but it happened when a friend of mine, Starley Kine, was there just before me, maybe a couple of months earlier. At the beginning, you have to go around, tell everybody a secret about yourself that you don't want people to know. And when Starley was there, the first person said, "My secret is that I haven't paid tax for 10 years. And everyone was like, "Oh, it's not such a great secret." And then the second secret was, "I killed a man." And then the third person was, this person had killed somebody, pushed him out of the car, nobody ever found out. Then the third person was, "Oh my God, my secrets are so boring. I suppose I can talk about how I have sex with my cat." And then the second person said, the murderer said, "Can I add something? I also have sex with my cat." I think that's hilarious.
So, I mean, where do you think this is going in the future, how can we sort of change how people behave on Twitter and all of that? What, are we going to carry on like this?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I want people to realise that, you know, human beings are a mixture of sins and talents and flaws, and I think I'm hoping my book will sort of change people's attitudes a little. I know I don't want to sound like Russell Brand, but I've got ambition for this book, like he had for his book. So I do want to sound like Russell Brand. I want this book to sort of change people's behaviour. Not think twice before they make a joke that might be misconstrued, mm-hmm. but think twice before tearing somebody apart for nothing.
I've been talking to John Ronson. We've been talking about his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Again, apologies for the noisy air conditioning unit in this room, but we're backstage at the Colchester Arts Centre before John goes on stage to do his gig. So, John, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Neil, thank you very much, and I'll see you next time, the next book.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.